Lecture 39, John F. Kennedy, a President in Crisis.
Good to see you again. In this lecture, we're going to begin our examination of the uncompleted single presidential term of John F. Kennedy. We will look at issues in both domestic and foreign policy. However, we'll reserve our discussion of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the key elements of the civil rights issue until our next lecture. Kennedy, as I indicated in the last lecture, proceeded more cautiously as president than his bold rhetoric might have suggested. He devoted much of his energy in dealing with major Cold War crises, crises that hit him very early in his presidential term. Unlike Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but like the last Democratic president, Harry Truman, Kennedy found that he could exercise much greater initiative in foreign affairs than he could in domestic policy. Some of the limitations that were imposed upon him in domestic policy, like having to deal with a cranky Congress, were really not as restrictive when it came to exercising initiative in the wider world. Before reaching the halfway point of his administration, Kennedy found that he had to deal with the humiliation of a failed exile invasion of Cuba, that he had to deal with Soviet pressure on Berlin, that he had to deal with a crisis in Southeast Asia, and that he had to deal with the Cuban Missile Crisis, a crisis that brought the United States and the Soviet Union perhaps to the brink of war. At home, he had to respond to the challenge of civil rights and to the need to balance a reform agenda against the so-called business confidence that Kennedy thought was so important for economic recovery and for American prosperity in the 1960s. In both domestic and foreign affairs, many of Kennedy's early initiatives did indeed revolve around the use of presidential power and the use of presidential power without explicit congressional involvement. He found that he could use the extraordinary powers of the presidency, powers that we've been discussing throughout this course, to do a great deal without actually having to get votes from the Congress. In his most heralded early move, Kennedy established by executive order of the president the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps, of course, would symbolize both the idealism and the activism of Kennedy's World War II generation. The Peace Corps would enable tens of thousands of Americans to go to less developed nations to try to help in the education of peoples around the world and to try to help less developed nations build their economy and build their technological base. President Kennedy also ordered a review of the Food for Peace program, established a presidential commission on the status of women in the United States, and expanded food assistance to the war-torn Congo. He also established a commission on equal employment opportunity and a commission on the space program. Both of these commissions would be headed by Vice President Lyndon Johnson. Following a strategy that was actually carefully planned out during the transition period, President Kennedy decided that he would not introduce any significant new civil rights legislation to the Congress. He did not believe that such legislation would pass. He thought it would only get him into trouble with Southern members of his own party and perhaps impede enactment of other critical domestic priorities. He decided in this realm as well to concentrate on executive initiatives, things he could do without the explicit authorization of the Congress. He appointed Robert Weaver, an African-American, to be head of the Housing and Home Loan Financing Agency. He would be the highest African-American federal appointee to that point. Weaver would eventually become the first black member of a presidential cabinet, but that would occur under Lyndon Johnson, not John Kennedy. Kennedy, however, failed to fulfill what had been a campaign pledge to end with a stroke of the pen discrimination in federally assisted housing. He would not take the step of signing an executive order until after the midterm elections of November of 1962. Although Kennedy would appoint other African Americans to at least middling positions in the government, he would be criticized by civil rights leaders for deferring to Southern Democrats and, in some cases, for appointing segregationist judges to the bench. Civil rights leader Martin Luther King would at one point chide the president by saying, quote, "If tokenism were our goal, the administration moves us adroitly towards it," unquote. Kennedy did, however, inspire many Americans when he took the initiative in May of 1961 to announce an American objective to land a man on the moon and to bring him back by the end of the decade. Again, he challenged Americans by saying, we weren't going to do this because it was easy, but we were going to do this precisely because it was a hard and challenging thing to do. Internationally, Kennedy took a considerable risk when he ordered an invasion of Cuba by exile forces. This was the invasion that had been planned by the CIA during the Eisenhower administration. It was the invasion that Richard Nixon felt he could not talk about during the 1960 campaign without, of course, compromising the operation. The so-called Third World of less developed nations had become a key battleground of the Cold War, as the Rand Report that we cited in the previous lecture had indicated. This phase of the Cold War had also become a key preoccupation of President Kennedy. It was a time when Khrushchev was calling for wars of national liberation around the globe. And remember, Kennedy was the guy who felt that we had to prepare ourselves to deal aggressively with international communism, and we simply could not let the communists pursue their objectives around the world without strong challenge. Kennedy, like Eisenhower before him, looked at Cuba as a source for the subversion of other countries of Latin America. He really worried that if you let Castro stay in Cuba, that the infection of communism would spread from Cuba to other Western Hemisphere nations. The invasion, known as Operation Zapata, was designed to land exile forces in Cuba and start an uprising among the Cuban people that would eventually topple the communist leader. They didn't think the small force itself could defeat Castro, but they hoped that a successful initial invasion would spark an internal revolt. Kennedy really launched the invasion of Cuba as an act of desperation. Documents from within the Kennedy administration indicate that he felt this was the last chance to overthrow Castro, that the window really was closing, and that if he didn't take this opportunity, one would not come again in the near future. However, Kennedy restricted American bombing operations prior to the invasion, and he refused to authorize American air cover for the invasion. He wanted the invasion on the one hand, but he didn't want too much overt American involvement on the other hand. The invasion, in effect, landed a small exile army of some 1,500 on what was known as the Bay of Pigs in Cuba on April 17th, 1961. It failed miserably, Most invaders were quickly captured by Castro's vastly superior military forces. And there was no indication that any uprising against Castro was about to occur. The invasion made the United States look simultaneously incompetent and imperialistic. It brought immediate criticism to the new Kennedy administration. However, an evaluation of the invasion only recently declassified found that the invasion was ill-conceived, incompetently planned, and poorly executed. There were so many flaws in the invasion plan, this report found, that it had no chance to succeed whatever. The report found it could not have succeeded even if the Americans had provided air cover for the invasion. Indeed, the report concluded that the impossibility of running this operation as a covert operation under the CIA should have been recognized as early as 5 months before the invasion. It should have been clear well ahead of time that this plan simply could not work even under the best of circumstances. Kennedy cursed himself for accepting the advice of the so-called experts who told him the invasion could work. But he accepted responsibility for one of the worst fiascos of the Cold War. And remarkably, his approval rating soared to an astonishing 83%. It was a lesson in perhaps the political value of owning up to one's own failures, but it was a lesson that many subsequent presidents would not come to heed. The failure in Cuba also gave Kennedy a deep appreciation of the incredible risks involved in taking hasty, dramatic action in foreign arenas where American control was limited. For all America's power, it did not have the capacity necessarily to have its own way in all parts of the world. As I mentioned, shortly following the failed invasion, Kennedy also sought to revive the spirits of Americans by announcing his goal to put a man on the moon. Ironically, though, Kennedy never did lose his obsession with dislodging the Castro regime from Cuba. During the Kennedy administration, the CIA and what was dubbed Operation Mongoose experimented with all kinds of bizarre and crazy schemes to try to do away with Castro. These schemes included, believe it or not, an exploding starfish and a poison-laden wetsuit designed to do away with the Cuban leader while he was skin diving. In the realm of legislation, Kennedy's accomplishments turned out to be modest. He implemented what could only be called a limited domestic reform agenda. During his first 2 years, the president did not resurrect fair deal proposals for national health insurance, for fundamentally revamped and reconstructed farm programs, or for major civil rights accomplishments. His ambitious aid to education program floundered in the politics of Congress. Kennedy would call his failure to get major education legislation the biggest disappointment on the domestic scene during his first year in office. Also, eventually, plans formulated by the administration for a Medicare program of health assistance to the aged also got stalled in the Congress. The actual accomplishments of John Kennedy included an increase in the minimum wage, new housing legislation, aid to economically depressed areas, an investment tax credit, and legislation mandating equal pay for women. The Equal Pay Act of 1963 was passed really with little fanfare. It required that men and women receive the same pay for the same work. Despite its lack of publicity in 1963, this was really the first major piece of legislation designed to deal with discrimination against women since the 1920s. It also would begin an extraordinary decade of change in laws involving women and involving gender relations in the United States. Changes during the subsequent 10-year period included Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that prohibited sex discrimination in employment. Changes included affirmative action programs for women, court decisions providing access to birth control and abortion. Changes also included Title IX of the Higher Education Act that prohibited sex discrimination in education. All in all, the Equal Pay Act of 63 did introduce a remarkable decade of changes in the status of women in the United States. Kennedy, initially on the domestic scene as well, rejected proposals from his Council of Economic Advisers for an aggressively expansionist fiscal policy and actively sought business support for his administration. Remember, he thought business confidence was important to prosperity. After a tumble in the stock market, though, in 1962, Kennedy changed course and became the first American president to propose an openly Keynesian approach to economic expansion. He called for a major tax cut proposal. He called for cuts in both personal and corporate income taxes to stimulate the American economy. Like Truman before him, Kennedy believed that a rising economy was essential if progressive goals, including the reduction of poverty, were to be achieved in the United States. Kennedy was also utterly determined that he would not face, in 1964, Nixon's problem of campaigning during a period of economic recession. As early as January of 1963, he ordered his economic advisors to put into place a plan to make sure that economic expansion continued through the election year. Quote, "Our minimum aim," wrote Council of Economic Advisers Chair Walter Heller in 1963, "is to avoid recession, which would mean keeping the expansion going for at least 45 months, which was the length of the Korean expansion," unquote. Indeed, they would meet that goal. Expansion would continue through 1964, but the beneficiary, of course, would be President Lyndon Johnson, then seeking election on his own. During his first year in office, the president was also very concerned with maintaining good relations with business and in sustaining business confidence. He was not prepared to follow the example of Franklin Roosevelt and launch an all-out attack on the quote-unquote economic royalists. In an August 1961 memo to the president, Chairman Heller of the Council of Economic Advisers stated that in relating to business, quote, "Let's not antagonize them or contribute to the image of a Kennedy administration versus business," unquote. By 1962, though, the president had become less concerned with courting the favor of business and more willing to directly challenge business priorities. In part, this reflected a recognition that a Democratic administration was simply not going to win business support. Remember, this was a realization that FDR also came to when he did indeed abandon his so-called concert of all interests and go after the economic royalists. In a 1962 memo, presidential advisor Ted Sorensen wrote, quote, "Most big businessmen are by conviction, habit, and association inherently opposed to this administration and its policies. No program could eliminate their opposition or lack of confidence to the extent that it is emotional, illogical, political, and inevitable, unquote. Inevitable business opposition. Kennedy's willingness to challenge business became most evident in his 1962 fight against a rise in steel prices. In 1962, the U.S. Steel Corporation broke what had been a voluntary wage price program that Kennedy had put into effect to control both wages and prices and keep the lid on inflation. After the steelworkers had agreed to sign a contract without a wage increase, on the premise that there would be no price increases, U.S. Steel went ahead and raised prices. An angry Kennedy went on television and denounced the, quote, tiny handful of steel executives whose pursuit of private power and profit exceeds their sense of public responsibility. Under pressure, the industry eventually rolled back their price increases, but the honeymoon between Kennedy and business was over. When the president was assassinated in November of 1963, the administration had moved to a more ambitious domestic agenda, including path-breaking civil rights legislation and programs that were at least in the works to try to fight poverty in the United States. All of these objectives, civil rights and a major poverty program, would be achieved under the next administration, that of Lyndon Johnson. As Professor Neustadt had warned, Kennedy, unlike Franklin Roosevelt, would have to deal with pressing international crises and could not focus on matters at home. But Kennedy often sought to link domestic policy and foreign policy to promote prosperity at home and reform abroad, as well as to combat communism. Kennedy implemented major new initiatives in foreign economic policy. One of his initiatives was very much in the spirit of FDR. Emulating Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, he began his Alliance for Progress. Under the alliance, the United States committed billions of dollars in aid to Latin America. It was a typical Kennedy initiative that tried to merge several goals. On the one hand, the alliance was designed to liberalize Latin American countries, to make them more democratic, to make them more progressive in their economic and social policies. But on the other hand, the alliance was also designed to fight communism. To the extent Kennedy believed these regimes could reform themselves, they would become more strongly resistant to communism. The alliance, however, didn't work as planned. The problems of Latin America were far more entrenched than Kennedy had anticipated, and there were problems in implementing the program. In 1963, an aide who had helped create the alliance reported that, quote, it is increasingly disappointing that a program which is sound in conception and historically right is operating at about one-half effectiveness, and that may be a generous estimate, unquote. Despite the problems of the alliance, though, and despite Castro staying in Cuba, there was not an expansion of communism to other nations of Latin America during the Kennedy administration. On other fronts, the president won passage of a Trade Expansion Act, a reorganized foreign aid program under the new Agency for International Development, and an expanded foreign aid budget. Kennedy also sought, really had to, deal with problems in Europe. And in late May and early June of 1961, he traveled to Europe to meet with foreign leaders. The handsome young president and his beautiful and stylish wife became the toasts of the continent. In a meeting with President de Gaulle in France, Kennedy reaffirmed America's commitment to protect Europe from any threat that might come from the East. In Vienna, Kennedy met with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. The two leaders made some progress in affirming a commitment to a neutral Laos in Southeast Asia, but made no progress on key issues involving the status of Berlin and Eastern Germany. Khrushchev threatened to sign a treaty with East Germany that would abrogate Western rights in Berlin. There was the real possibility of another Berlin crisis like the one that Harry Truman faced in 1948. Soviet-American relations continued to go downhill after Vienna as Moscow ended a nuclear testing moratorium it had initiated during the Eisenhower years. Kennedy responded to potential threats to Berlin by mobilizing U.S. reserve forces, asking for increased defense spending, and even indicating that he was prepared to go to war to keep Berlin free. But Khrushchev backed down, not the young American leader, and his retreat was tacitly acknowledged by the building of a massive concrete and barbed wire wall to halt the flood of refugees from the Soviet-dominated eastern sector of Berlin to the west. Although American and Russian tanks faced each other in Berlin, no serious incident occurred. The Berlin crisis, though, was particularly frightening because American war plans pretty much indicated that any kind of conflict in Europe was likely to lead to the use of nuclear weapons. The military buildup begun during the Berlin crisis would continue during the Kennedy years. Indeed, during these years, America established its so-called triad of nuclear deterrence: land-based missiles, sea-based missiles based on submarines, and manned bombers. It was also during this period that there would, of course, be an escalation in the arms race between the United States and the Soviets. Kennedy also sought to strengthen the NATO alliance. He strongly supported the European common market as a way of uniting Europe economically. He also sought to reaffirm the American commitment to Europe by trying to establish what he called a multilateral force, or MLF, that would consist of nuclear arms ships and submarines that would be under joint NATO control, with the U.S. retaining a veto over final use. The MLF, however, was not especially popular in Europe and was never implemented. But Kennedy's problems were not limited to Europe. He had inherited from Truman and Eisenhower unlimited American strategic commitments that spread throughout the globe. He faced considerable challenges in such areas of the world as the Congo, the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent. But the greatest challenges would occur in Southeast Asia. The country of Laos was in the throes of revolution when Kennedy became president, with the communist Pathet Lao making considerable military progress. Kennedy, however, what would become crucial for subsequent events, resisted pressure from many of his key military advisors to seek a military solution in Laos. Instead, he sought to use diplomacy without flatly ruling out military intervention to negotiate the formation of an independent, neutral government for that nation. In Vienna, Khrushchev indicated he would use his influence to achieve that end. But in May of 1962, a continuation of the fighting in Laos prompted the United States into a show of force with naval and ground forces. However, in July of that year, at the Second Geneva Conference, the United States and other nations did agree to protect the independence and neutrality of Laos. Peace did not come to prevail in that nation, but at least Kennedy had avoided either direct major military involvement or simply letting Laos fall to the communists. More perilous was the situation in Vietnam. By the time Kennedy became president, South Vietnam, under the control of President Ngo Diem, was in a fierce struggle against communist guerrillas, the Viet Cong, supported by the North, the communist nation of North Vietnam. Kennedy, again, was unwilling to back down in Vietnam, but also resisted proposals for large-scale American military involvement. Remember, he had always been skeptical about America imposing its will in Southeast Asia. However, he would go to great lengths to try to assist the South Vietnamese government in its campaign against the Viet Cong. The United States had less than 1,000 advisors in South Vietnam at the beginning of his term. By the end of 1963, that number would surpass 16,000. Yet even that number of advisors could not turn the tide of battle in favor of the South Vietnamese. We will, of course, never know what Kennedy's final policy in South Vietnam would have been. We'll never know if he would have led the nation into the tragedy of Vietnam, the way Lyndon Johnson, of course, did when he became president of the United States. In his final speech, though, one that was never delivered, it was scheduled for delivery in Dallas on November 22, 1963, he did reaffirm his commitment to supporting the anti-communist efforts of the government of South Vietnam.